Hi, everybody.
Hi.
I think we're going to get started. And we're going to try to make this as interactive as possible. And I know everybody says that, but we're going to try to do it. So we're going to try to get through our stuff quickly. So try to think of things to say or questions to ask. And is Ben here yet?
No. Okay. Maybe he'll never
show.
We
may have a guest. We may not. So what's the title of our panel? Okay. So Justin and I are going to talk about online games and how and what we can learn from them and things like that. So let's see if we can switch.
There you are. I switched.
Right. So first, I wanted to. A lot of people ask this question, so I'm going to talk about it first, which is, I play World of Warcraft and I mess around in Second Life a lot, and a lot of people compare them. But I think it's kind of stupid to compare them. I think comparing them is like comparing apples and oranges. Anybody who's played text MUDs in the past knows that at some point, MUs and MUDs kind of split. MUs attracted people who were really focused on the game-making part, making objects and creating and developing worlds as the fun stuff to do on the net. And you know, people who were into furries, people who were into making up fantasies and role-playing tended to go towards MUs. And you couldn't kill people, or at least it was difficult to kill people, and it wasn't the point of MUs. Whereas MUDs focus more and more on the gameplay, on scarcity, and coming up with ways to have quests and levels and things like that. And ever since then, it's quite a different community and different approach. And so while they're similar in that they're 3D games, and while Second Life guys will often tell you, well, you can make a game inside of Second Life, and we could do World of Warcraft, that's really not the point, and that's not really where it's going. So I don't think it's very good to compare them, but it is interesting to compare these two in the context of kind of what you learn from them and what kind of activities you would do, and we can talk about that a little bit. So I think it's World of Warcraft and Second Life, not World of Warcraft or Second Life. Personally, I use Second Life. I play my World of Warcraft videos inside of Second Life, and we sit around and we talk about our raids. We also plan raids inside of Second Life because we can import our maps and sit around and talk about our raids. But for me, Second Life is really more for simulation, and I do lots of ritual there, talks and things like that. And it's a very interesting space because you can do what you want, but it's really not where I build relationships, although different people do that. How many people already know what World of Warcraft is and don't need to learn?
Holy smokes. All right, so okay, if you don't know, then you're surrounded, you can talk to them.
So I'm going to skip that section where I talk about how that works. So this is actually a slide that Justin made, which is the interface for World of Warcraft. And if you think about it, I think if you go all the way back to the LambdaMu days, or even before that, Pavel Curtis was saying the whole internet, the interface will eventually be MUDs or MUs. And games are wonderful interfaces because they develop through a very rigorous interaction between the developers and the people who make the games and use the games. And I think that if you think of World of Warcraft as an evolutionary point right now in interface design, you could imagine this becoming the interface for everything you do on the web or on the internet. But what's amazing about World of Warcraft and a lot of games, but particularly about World of Warcraft right now, is that you can make add-ons. And so there's a Lua add-on scripting that you can do, and this is actually my modded up version of my UI. This is a little bit old, but we have most of this stuff is user generated. So we've got threat meters, we've got all kinds of very sophisticated stuff that parses the stuff that the game creates to give me a display that looks almost like flying by instruments. You know, and so sometimes the 3D world is really important, but when I'm engaged in a boss fight, it's like a pilot looking at the instruments rather than looking at the terrain. And what's interesting about this is that Blizzard will take a lot of these good add-ons and pull them into the real interface, but a lot of the innovation happens in the user community.
So can we take a break 1 second here and actually go into what some of these specific pieces are? Because it's really bright and lively. And maybe we could... Could we lower the lights just temporarily? Not long enough to cause us some somnambulance, but until Ben gets up on stage, maybe we'll lower the lights.
Right. I mean, the deal is that we have to pay $5 for every person that falls asleep.
So. Oh, rats.
So up here on the left... are the 40 people in our raid. It shows their status. And so if you think about it from a project management perspective, these are like having little meters on everybody's chair to tell if they're awake, if they're asleep, how much energy they have, how much brains they have. This in the middle, because I'm a mage, tells me that I need to decurse these people. This is the boss, shows how much stuff, energy he's got left. This is 8 channels of chat in different colors going on. So the raid chat, guild chat, class chat, private chat. This is pretty fancy. It's a threat meter. So whenever you're shooting or attacking bosses or casting spells, you generate different kinds of threat. And so the whole trick of this fight is to get the boss mad at the warrior who is armored and being healed. And then for the casters, like the healers and the people who are the mages who don't have any armor, to not attract threats. So as a mage, what I'm trying to do is do as much damage as possible without getting the attention of the boss. And this is a very sophisticated add-on because it has to calculate the threat generated by all the different spells. And the threat generated by that isn't necessarily published by Blizzard, so they go doing tests and tests and tests and trying to generate the most accurate threat meters that they can. And every time there's a patch and the boss changes or the spells change, they have to update this thing. And it's something that, again, the community has developed. This is the damage that all the different players are causing.
So it's sort of like their effectiveness.
Yeah. So for instance, the healers will track who's doing the most healing. Since I'm a damage cannon with no armor, I'm on the top of this meter, but I think in this fight I die because I get the threat. This is what our tanks are pointing at. These are spells that I can cast. This is a system box. These meters are the most important ones that show, you know, my health, my mana versus my targets. These are spells that I'm casting. These are stats on the monster that I'm targeting. So there's a bunch of stuff going on, and probably no two players' interfaces are exactly the same. And the point here is that there are a couple points here, but the one thing is that we have a lot of military kids in our guild, actually. There are some soldiers that are actually deployed in Iraq, and they say that, you know, this is way ahead of the kind of instrumentation and interface and bandwidth of information that they get in some of their military displays. I know this is a lot better than any kind of real-time project management software that I have to track 40 people. And if you think about it, I mean, it is a lot like project management in the real world. It's 40 people showing up on time, being penalized if they're 15 minutes late, 8 different classes with 8 different roles, people rotating in and out, and people having to do what they have to do and being scored and being tracked. And all this data is logged later so I can analyze it and say, hey, you were overhealing. You should have been healing the people who needed the healing. Or you kept taking all these consumables that costs our guild money, and you should figure out a way to not take so many potions. And this is way ahead of where we have enterprise software. The other thing is, as these people get into positions of you know, being managers and start hiring guildies, because I'm now sending guildies to companies that I work with or portfolio companies, because I know how they act under pressure. I know whether they're going to show up on time every week. I know whether they cheat or not. I know whether they lie or not. I know more about my guildies under pressure than I know about anybody else in any community that I'm a part of. And we also share this common interface, so we can use the lingo from World of Warcraft. I mean, you just cause aggro, or maybe you should lower your threat, and all these things are things that you could convert into business talk. One other important thing, which is outside of the game, is the use of audio. So we use TeamSpeak or Ventrilo. This is actually a picture that Justin did for a magazine called Game World Events. Richard Bartle was one of the developers of the original MUD, and he had this to say about immersive environments versus the audio. And he thought that audio shatters this fantasy. And so a lot of game developers don't build the audio chat into it, because suddenly if a night elf, female night elf, has a husky men's voice, it sort of breaks the fantasy. The fact of the matter is, the fantasy, I believe, is already broken. And I think that we used to have this notion of being in cyberspace or being in the real world, and you kind of turned it off. Well, there is no difference anymore. I mean, my guildies chat me, they SMS me, I have TeamSpeak on my speakers, and for me, the guild is really a common, the game is just a common activity that we do in this community that we have. And so I think everybody probably saw
Stan. Stan!
Hang on, guys, my dad wants something.
Stan!
What?
You've been on your computer all weekend. Shouldn't you go out and socialize with your friends?
I am socializing, Artard. I'm logged on to an MMORPG with people from all over the world and getting XP with my party using TeamSpeak.
I'm not an Artard.
All right, sorry, guys.
So, I mean, I think it shows that we go seamlessly between the real world and the game, and I don't think that separating that out as a fantasy is practical anymore. A couple of other things, though. Oops, this is, I'll skip that. A lot of people also ask the question. I was at a talk with Stephen Johnson the other day, and he wrote this book. I think Everything Bad Is Good for You, and he was saying that you know video games are actually good for you and things like that. But one of the criticisms he said he kept getting was that well, there's no imagination left, and a lot of criticism of 3D is well, you know. It was better when it was text because you imagine things. And his response was great, which was, well, is it better then if you don't go to Paris and sit in your bedroom imagining Paris? You know, because the thing is that when you enter a new world, it's a new platform on which you can have experiences and you can imagine and you can become creative. And there's an excellent paper by Douglas Thomas and John C. Lee Brown that's a work in progress that you can find on the USC site. But they use they make a very interesting distinction between simulation and metaphor, simile and metaphor. And they say that simulation, which is in a way what Second Life does, which is to make a practically the same model in the real world, like a simulator. So a McDonald's job simulation would be something that looked exactly like McDonald's, and you have the hat and you have the timers and all that, and it teaches you how to act and be a McDonald's employee, versus something like World of Warcraft, where you have 40 people gathering to enter Molten Core here, and it has nothing to do with real life, but the leadership skills and the feeling of being together and this tribal thing is metaphorically similar to what happens in the workplace. So instead of learning sort of direct knowledge through having something that's a replica of the real world, you learn something much more creative in it and sort of stimulate your imagination about this is a completely different world, but what one thing is similar from here with my real world and what can I learn from that? And John C. Lee Brown uses this word ensemble, which is when you're playing music together and you get in the zone and you just feel like it's just working. So this is an extreme. And this is really kind of what it feels like in your head, like you're playing music together and it just comes together. And this feeling of it just working and having all those hours of time pay off is a kind of reward that you get. And then we have really young people in here. We have people who have never been in groups like this suddenly understand why they're doing what they were told. For instance, like if you go to, like we have 13-year-old kids in the guild, or we have 8-year-old kids in the guild, and if you tell them to go to, when they're in church or something, be quiet. They don't know why. And when you try to explain why, it's very complicated. But if you're trying to get ready and prepare for a fight with a dragon, they know why they shouldn't be yapping. They know why they should be standing where they're told. And then there's a reward. And the reward isn't just gear, but there's this kind of sense of having worked in a team together and getting it just right. And I think that's a really important thing to learn. And the other thing that's interesting is a lot of the leaders here aren't the kind of MBA type leaders, which is also really important. Actually, I find leaders in our guild are much more similar to open source project leaders. They're listeners. So our raid leader, who's in charge of our military wing of our guild, is a night shift nurse. You know, and we've got you know bartenders and foremen, and in fact there are a couple of company CEOs and MBA types who have tried to be leaders in our guild who have failed. And a lot of it I attribute to the fact that a lot of people who are in business, first of all, they pay their employees, so they expect that they listen to them and do what they're told. But in the game, the players are paying to play. So they leave if it's not interesting, which is a lot more like open source. And I think that there's a power relationship between employer and employee in corporations, and sort of MBAs are about, you do have you know sort of obligatory discussions about morale and stuff like that, but basically you assume that people do as they're told because they're economically sort of attached to that. And it's about efficiency and things like that, but that doesn't work in a volunteer organization. And I think the guild is actually a lot more like a congregation than it is like a company. And leadership in this situation actually is a lot more like leading a really fresh startup or an open source project. Okay. I think I can skip this and then we can go into that later. But those are just some thoughts about what we can learn from
online
games.
Okay, great. So I'm going to take off where Joey left off, which is, you know, lots of excitement in World of Warcraft. And I don't play World of Warcraft because it just takes so much time. It takes so much time to play World of Warcraft, and when you load it, it takes over your whole screen. And you're sort of forced to be in this 3D world, and it's kind of difficult to multitask, and you have to put in the type of hours that Joey's put in to get to the point where the community, you know, is in your, where you know all the people in your IM list who are your guild leaders and the foreman and the night shift nurses are ringing you up on Skype and, you know, coming through your home stereo and all this stuff. So I don't have the time for it, and I don't, the results, what I achieve in World of Warcraft, I can't take elsewhere, which I like to take elsewhere. So I used to write about my life on the internet. I spent about 11 years at a couple thousand pages just detailing all my affairs, and it's really exciting to look back, and I stopped for a lot of different reasons, but what I don't have anymore is I don't have that trail of essays about my life that I used to generate regularly, and I miss that trail because I can see how bad a writer I used to be. And then the other reason I miss, but then what I've gained is I've gained a lot of time because I don't do that kind of writing anymore. But if I want that kind of trail, then I've been experimenting with other ways of getting that trail. So this is my MySpace page, myspace.com/JustinReach. So if you look, go there, you see from the upper right corner, you see my places. That tells you where the last wired or wireless internet login points were for me. And right below that, you see what video games I've been playing lately on my Xbox. And below that are recent photos of me or that I've taken on Flickr. And to the left are songs I'm listening to. So, again, if you took the time to sort of look over this and think about it, you could get a sense of the essay I might have written about the mood I was in and where what I was doing and the music I was listening to and all that stuff. But I don't have to do anything. All I have to do is continue using my computer and playing my games and having fun, and the internet is sort of notified with an understanding of who I am and what I'm doing. So I want to bring this sort of, you know, earning experience. I look at this as like I earned experience points in those areas, and these myware softwares, these like personal spyware programs, are tracking my experience points. In me, LastFM tracks experience points in music, and Places.com gives you experience points for, you know, logging into lots of weird Wi-Fi spots. I went to Africa and I took my laptop pretty much only to score up in Places because I knew I could first, you know, I could be the first one to score a bunch of those Wi-Fi hotspots in Africa. So. I wanted to apply that ability to get experience points for different areas of my life to life online. So I'm working on this idea called passively multiplayer online games. So it's watching you surf the web and then giving you experience points just for using your computer. So someday you might be as high a level as Joey, but all you did was just keep doing what you're doing. So the first draft I did of this, the BBC looked at this project and thought maybe this could be a way to teach people web literacy, because if I'm following you around the web, I would know a lot about what you look at and how much you read. And maybe you only read the same 5 sites every day, and I could say, hey, you're only level 5, you go to these 5 sites. I'm going to give you a quest and some experience points if you will read outside of your comfort zone. And that's a way to encourage web literacy. So we did a prototype for the BBC that was very accessible to new users because it pops up in a window and it's just a frame that sits above your sort of main screen where you're surfing and tracks and gives you experience points for what you're surfing and then prompts you to do other things. The problem is the frame broke on Wikipedia. And that, I mean, that's like, wow, I wrestled with that for a long time. We're still working on that. So, but basically, just to summarize, this is something I'm kind of embarrassed about. This is a slide that gives you a sense of how we give experience points right now. I wanted to use a philosophy of iteration, of rapidly prototyping things. So I went to the open directory, and I took all their categories, and then I hand tag URLs with categories. So it's back asswards, man. And if somebody wants to help me scrape delicious or something after the panel, let's do it. I got an Evdo card. We can get on the internet. What I've got going right now is that you're getting experience points. At least I can start to see what it feels like, and the genres are sort of a rough mapping to the ways that people surf. And you start to get a sense of what the user profiles look like. So this is a user profile of a guy who does an enormous amount, spends an enormous enormous amount of time on Wikipedia and Google, so his reference score is sort of off chart. And you can see that we have the type of characteristics at the bottom that are written out in text are things that he would, that we hope to be able to see about you someday, right? Do you get up immediately in the morning and use your computer for 3 hours and then tend to, you know, drift away from that in the afternoon? We could give you a trait or a badge for doing that. So right now you opt in on those things. And we can tell what countries you surf in and what browsers you're using. So my model for this was looking at a D&D character sheet, and a D&D character sheet proposes to know a lot in quantifiable ways about people. I struggled with a lot of different schemes, ways that you could classify human beings. They're all flawed, FYI. You know, Myers-Briggs, astrology, seven deadly sins. I mean, I don't know how you want to talk about what the traits describe people, but we went for genres of websites. So our current draft is a Firefox sidebar that you can download and install, and basically while you're surfing, it's just adding these experience points to your profile and keeping track of sort of the time of day. We ditched the URLs so that no one could ever subpoena us and say, man, where does Joey Ito go on the web? We would never be able to tell you that, but we could say Joey has a higher news score than he has shopping score. So that's where we're currently at, and we have quests where people can sort of go out on the web. And then in the future, what we're looking at is we've designed a board game prototype of an interplay between different types of people. So we use the type of sites you go to categorize you into a different one of four character classes. And then each of those character classes has a tool, and each of those tools is sort of a rock, paper, scissorsy thing that you can lay on a website. And so we're testing the board game to make, and the board game uses this fiction that we have a wiki to develop the fiction. And then we're making a micro format so that the game can be opened up so that on your website you could have an object that fits into this role-playing economy. So someone comes to your website and says, I want to pick up the cool red hair dye, and then I'm going to, you know, that's what people can get from me. And then, you know, so that's what you could do. So we have this test running up now, and some of the, you know, it's very raw.
Yeah. Justin, do you get bonus points for being a spaz? Can I ask you a question, though?
I want to track carbon points.
What's multi-user about it? I mean, what's multiplayer about it?
Oh, yeah. So if you look in the Firefox sidebar, there's a chat. And that's what we have. There's a chat. And so you can chat with other people. And you can, and there's leaderboards, man. It's multiplayer because we have leaderboards. You can see, man, I'm not as much of a reference surfer as the other person. But the problem is right now that the whole game only rewards lots of use of the internet. And I want to be able to reward sort of balanced or nuanced use of the internet. Or not even reward, but just profile these things. And so what we're reaching for is these dynamics where people can sort of be exchanged. There'll be lots of avenues in which to succeed, and if you look at World of Warcraft, you could be the best crafter or the best leveler or the best damage dealer or the best healer, but there's no one path to truth.
Thank you. And you know, I knew it was going to kind of be like this, so we have somebody who is not a spaz and who's neutral.
Yes.
And
three characters.
And maybe you could like, if you have some thoughts and some insight.
I'm the contemplator character class. I think we work well in parties with the spaz, actually, it turns out. So
this is Ben Cervny, and he doesn't have his own website.
I'm invisible to Justin's game, actually. I'm one of the highest value resources to be collected. I'm also summonable by other people in the party, apparently. I was participating in a panel yesterday about virtual humans and virtual worlds, and that was sort of, I thought that was going to trend a little bit more towards the AI creation side, so I was a little bit worried that I was not entirely in my domain, because that's not what I think about. I actually think about more designing these sort of systems of interaction that make kind of frameworks for play, whether they're officially games or not. And one of the things that I wanted to sort of comment on about where Joey and I had along with Stephen Johnson, presented sort of in a row last week at GDC, and it was kind of this serendipitous long Zoom, really, from the cultural anthropology that Stephen Johnson was sort of taking on to Joy, talking about the way that these systems are operational in the WoW context, and how you know, we're sort of slowly transitioning from the idea of, you know, play spaces to kind of metaphors for organizational systems. And so what I wanted to talk a little bit about was this idea of, you know, the transit and the sort of dissolving border between what we currently call applications, what we currently call games in computation. And mainly that has to do with the fact that, well, to step back a little bit, there was a book written in the mid-90s by a fellow named Malcolm McCullough that was called Abstracting Craft. And one of the things that he talked about in that book was the idea that a tool is basically the sculpture of constraints in possibility space. So if you are trying to make something that allows other people to make things, what you're doing is basically building in a subset of all possible things that can be made. You're sort of promoting one subset of things over another, over all the possible things that could be made. And the thing that's interesting about that is that when you talk about game design, basically you are also creating a sculpture in possibility space. You're constraining the actions of a player into, if anyone was here for Warren Spector's talk, the idea that you're sort of constraining the possible trajectories through the making of a story that is the trace of the player through the experience. That was fantastic.
Can we raise the lights?
Apparently I've leveled up in rhetoric, But I think that where we're sort of going with this is the fact that, you know, we are beginning to, you know, the real sort of abstract resource that we find in play are these metaphors that Joey was talking about, and this sort of the fact that we have interactions with computation, which turn out to really be interactions with complex systems, whether they're computationally presented or things that happen in the world, like organizations, which is, you know, sort of, I think, the metaphor that, or the movement between those two things is what Joey's pointing out in the way that these tools are evolving in Warcraft. And I think in general, we're mining metaphors out of the play space and into the application space. And so as we kind of progressively do that, we're going to, you know, culture is starting to fill up with some of the, I mean, one of the things you see all the time in if you go to interaction design conferences, like what happened, say, in 1980 is now showing up in games now. Like there are these things like marking menus and various other techniques that people have sort of been languishing in SIGCHI, you know, manuals that are sitting, you know, gathering dust in some researcher's, you know, cabinet, but then some, you know, game designer realizes that there is a context in which that can be applicable to the metaphor that they're trying to construct for the way that players are going to control their environment in the game, and then that becomes an artifact of popular culture, and suddenly, you know, this thing that was languishing maybe, you know, gets used in some super high-end application that nobody is really, you know, nobody in popular culture is engaging with. That's, you know, that now, you know, now we're about to see that. I think, you know, we've seen that already in the Sims and various other contexts where some of these tools have been brought out and now, you know, become part of this language that everyone can use to discuss how they would imagine controlling a task in a virtual space. So that, you know, that becomes it's just the popularization of metaphors that then can be used and recycled, you know, remixed in sort of creative applications and ways of participatory culture, you know, the construction of shared environments and the ways that we trade sort of artifacts of media with each other. All of those things can be, you know, sort of, I mean, the classical story that we tell, you know, coming out of the experience that we had at Ludicorp was that what started off as a massively multiplayer game ended up as an application for trading media, and that was not a coincidence. It was, you know, the fact that there was, you know, the thread that we followed was the thread of play, you know, and it brought us into a space that related us to our own media in a totally different way. And that was, I think, the seed of what made a success out of that application was not so much that application being Flickr. Thank you. The reason why that succeeded was that it came from a totally different approach, which is the space of play. It's a different process, you know, just in the same sense that we have this idea of flow that Csikszentmihalyi wrote about in a sort of book about cognitive psychology. I don't know when that was published, but it was this idea that you maintain a sort of optimum experience by having, you know, a balance between the simplicity of task and the complexity of task, and that's also something that Stephen Johnson mentions is everything bad is good for you. That the construction of flow, it turns out,
is aided by sort of being in the state of play, the idea that you have, because there's a different relationship you have with risk and reward and learning in play than you do have in the sense of like traditional computing, where if you make a mistake, you might, you know, be punished by your boss or something like that. Whereas in play, you know, you have a sense of experimentation that allows you to you can find, rather than letting the application set the context for where your state of flow is, instead you can play with the level of complexity with your, and you can add as many, you know, 2D plug-in surfaces on top of your 3D environment as you want. You can either be immersed in sort of the simple tasks of the experience of WoW, or you can go really far out into this metagame of understanding all of the properties that are dynamically being changed in your environment and sort of begin to play in this much more sort of organizationally aware state. And that's up to you, because that's what play affords, is this idea of kind of the long zoom in and out of complexity that you're in control of.
Wow. So, I mean, I guess because I... Oh, let's take questions if you want. Come up to the microphone. I was going to ask, I mean, the two of you, do you think that, like, the Microsoft Office 2008 should be something where you have, like, the rich presence of a Jaiku or a gear up that's showing whether your buddy's awake or in the office, and then you have the plus, the Messenger? I mean, if Messenger had better away lists that did stuff like tell you what your buddies were working on, like, okay, there's an application called Slife. It was called OnLife, and now it's called Slife. And it's basically TIA, Total Information Awareness, for your laptop. And you can run it, and it basically publishes the contents of your frontmost window to the web so that people can see, like, what you are surfing right now, what you are typing on right now, what your email is, you know. So, but it's this idea that if we knew this about each other, we would be so much more in touch, right? I mean, if the internet... Hey, if the internet is the first stage in the like coming telepathy that is inevitable in 100 years or whatever, like, we will have to know what everybody's doing all the time. So, I mean, in a small enough group, it's okay to say, I'm going to know what's on your screen at all times, and that'd be fun, or I'd like to do that, or that'd be useful, because I might I might interrupt Joey conditioned upon what he's doing, you know. So, and I might say, Ben, stop looking at that and work on your personal website. So, Do we see that but the, how much you know about people in a World of Warcraft context with all your Lua, do you feel like that's coming to the office?
Well, can I answer that from a different direction? I think, you know, the United States is an anomaly from the rest of the world, because they don't treat children or kids or play seriously. Seriously sounds weird, but like every stupid thing like this, they first start, how does this affect business? What about an enterprise application? Well, the first thing we do in Japan is we figure out, oh, kids use pagers to communicate with each other. The mobile phone should be for kids, because they're always the one innovating, because they play around and have fun, and they're the ones that figure out that texting is cool, right? And then the business people say, oh, okay, so then how does what the kids do affect business? How are they using the mobile device to create these polychronic environments where time and space don't matter, and they swarm around, oh, this is really cool, how does that affect our business? In the United States, they ask stupid questions like you just asked. When is this going to, you know, when is Microsoft going to get around this? And it's really kind of stupid, because the whole notion is that work, I mean, it comes to the Puritan thing. It's like work should not be fun. And fun is what kids do. And fun is a separate thing that you should stop doing when you become an adult. Right. Well, fun is actually means the interface is engaging. It's like the Macintosh. It's fun to work, and so your productivity goes up. And so that notion, and so Twitter, we're all doing it here. Well, guess what? That's what Europe and Japan have been doing for a long time. It's called texting. And finally, America discovers texting through Twitter, which is great. Finally, you guys are here, and maybe now you'll start figuring out that these mobile devices can do more than, like, do conference calls, right? So.
Check your outlook.
So I think that this whole, like, barrier between play and work is a pretty American thing. Just like the whole notion of cyberspace and real world is an American artifact. It's because you can't be in cyberspace when you're driving your car. You chuck your laptop in the back. But in Japan or Europe, you're always online while you're walking around. And so, you know, cyberspace is part of the real world, right? It's this driving economy. And the size of these darn things are for people who have cars. These suck when you're, like, trying to take a train, right? So a lot of the world has been warped by this American puritanic view of cyberspace and real life and play and work. And so I would rather you didn't bring those metaphors, actually. And similarly, I think that the game industry has been stigmatized a bit because it was kind of it was sort of a global effort. And wait, are we're giving these kids too much stuff, right? Are they learning the right things? And this whole notion of imagination and stuff like that we were talking about, they don't get there. They're like, oh, this is about violence. This is escapist. This is addictive. And they emphasize all these things that they don't want kids to do. And the other thing that I actually walked away from GDC with was this awful feeling that gaming was being controlled by something that looked a lot like Hollywood. Like, I could imagine a lot of the gaming companies doing stupid things like the RIA did, which was treating kids as kids and making them feel like criminals and trying to push them out. When the internet is finally touching gaming, I think there was a collision happening at GDC, which was the sort of Web 2 internet sort of, hey, let the users innovate, empower the user mm-hmm. type people versus let's control the experience, let's lock out people, let's not build APIs. Are we losing control? And I think this control versus being open also has a lot to do with whether you trust kids, whether you trust your users. And it has a lot to do, I think, with this kind of latent ageism as well that we
have.
Well, it's also
a question of power. I mean, pedagogy is always about power because you're transferring a set of memes that are about a structure. And that's basically, I mean, play is something that eats away at structure. I mean, that's exactly what it is this idea that, you know, that you're... By melting things into recombinant parts, you're taking away the towers that have already been built. To use a, I guess, too pregnant of a metaphor, but I guess the idea that you can, playfulness is something that allows you to look at things from many angles. Because I was saying, as you're sort of, you know, swerving through all of these, you know, nonlinear multiplicities of possibility, you're constantly, you know, it's like you can get a view, multiple perspectives so fast that you begin to question a dogma, you know, and that's there are a lot of people that are serving up dogma that are not excited about that prospect.
Let's take a question from the audience. Will you please introduce yourself and any affiliation you care to?
I'm Dinah Sanders. I have the blog Metagirl, which is, I don't know, 8 years or 9 years old. I had a couple things I wanted to carry on from what you were saying. I think one of the things that I notice a lot about work is that our notion of acceptable work and appropriate behavior in work is really not very old. It's like Frederick Taylor on. You know, we're talking controlled motion. You come to work, you plug into your machine, you think about nothing else for 4 hours, you take a break, and then you come back and you think about nothing else for 4 hours. And this idea, all the corporate fear over instant messaging immersing into the work environment, internet access immersing into the work environment, threatens that model of work, but that's not actually the traditional model of work. If you imagine a craftsperson, they're standing in the middle of a village. The family is around them. They're working on things in an environment that is constantly shifting between what we traditionally think of as life and work. And so one of the things that I would think of as you're designing for this play space and this playful approach to all apps is to watch for yourself building false dichotomies or believing in false separations that really aren't there, that are not part of our natural behavior. Just to sort of tie off of what you were saying before, that those separations may be completely false. And the other thing that we had talked about before, I think maybe when I was reading some of the things that that you put up about PMOG, or maybe I commented on your Flickr post, what I would like to see as you go forward with this like passive play experiment in the web itself, I want to see what somebody like Merlin Mann writes. What kind of games and quests does he create? If I could have something that was running to watch my use of email and see how much I'm running when the bell rings and wasting my time for the reward of a new little food pellet coming in, and reward me instead with experience points for chunking my email and getting in the flow the rest of the time.
Yeah, two things to say to that. One is that there's a company called Siriosity that's speaking directly to your last point, which is that they make a plugin for Microsoft Outlook that watches how you use email and then gives you badges for what they call bunching, is what you call chunking. So they say if you stay out of your email every time you stay out of your email for at least 15 minutes, you get another point in bunching. So you can see, and then they map your organization according to who has levels in different use of email. So some people are awarded for bunching, some people are high volume, some people email a lot of people, some people keep threads going a long time, and the Seriosity plugin watches and rewards all these different things. So I think they're playing directly in the productivity meets game mechanics space. And then you said something else that I wanted to talk about. Merlin Mann, watching Merlin Mann. So when I first talked about passively multiplayer with Joey and with Ben, I was getting the feedback I got was this could be something like Web Scouts, where you watch people and it's like, hey, you just edited a controversial Wikipedia article and sorted out the truth. That's a merit. You know, you just, you tag other people's pictures on Flickr. That's a merit badge. And, you know, I feel like the space of passively multiplayer online games is a huge space, you know, that I share with a lot of people. And so what I want to build is as open and compatible as possible so that you can, whatever I manage to slice up and describe about your web experience or Merlin Mann's web experience, that other people could follow his trails or see that he's a good citizen or a bad citizen or a fun citizen or whatever. I mean, you want to talk about false dichotomies, though. I mean, what makes a good internet citizen is like, it makes me crazy to think about that. So I'm just trying to do a slice and start there and then build up to the point where I can reward or sort of track or sort of profile different behavior, more sophisticated behaviors than top-level domain hits.
Molly. Hi, I'm Laren Jiddick. I'm Molly Steenson. I'm girlwonder.com, and I'm a student at the Yale School of Architecture. And I want to throw out there this notion of ways to subvert, which is kind of the undercurrent of what we're talking about. I want to throw out there the Paskian notion of boredom. Gordon Pask was a cybernetician, the inventor of the Musicolor machine, and somebody who created boredom routines. The Musicolor machine was invented in 1953. And believe me, we'll get back around to how this deals with all of this in a second. 1953, a series of lights that you'd play along with. It wasn't a strict if this, then this kind of if-then model, but it would get bored with you if you didn't do enough interesting musical change with the Musicolor machine. It would stop interacting with you. And then you'd have to find something new to do to get its attention back. An architect.
How do you spell his last name?
P-A-S-K. And Paul Pangaro, who people probably know, P-A-N-G-A-R-O .com, has a lot of information on Pask. But what's kind of fascinating is this also leapt into architecture and the work of Cedric Price and looking at responsive architecture and boredom routines for the spaces that we're in. So I start beginning to wonder, how does this start leaking into the world? I mean, we're talking about things that we're doing when we're interacting with screens, and we're talking about games that we're playing in order to suggest new interactions, and we're talking about various things to subvert the models we know. I start wondering what does happen when it actually gets into the real world, not in a didactic kind of everywhere way, but in this subversive way. And I wonder how we can start implementing these boredom routines in our lives so that once in a while, the things that we do stop responding, give us the fuck you, and then we've got to figure out a new way to respond. I don't know if that's a comment or a question. Maybe Ben can take that one up.
Well, I think there's definitely, one of the things that Stuart Butterfield and I talked a lot about and in the when we were first talking about Game Never Ending many Southwests ago, was this concept of flipping into play, which is basically it's almost like a koan, right? I mean, all you need is a little bit of a trigger that gets you to think differently about something, to use a patented phrase. But the idea that you can have something that triggers, you know, whether it's just a little shard that comes from a game world that gives you a sort of a poke about the fact that, you know, you're living in multiple worlds at once. That's something that like zooms you out of the moment and into sort of the meta moment a little bit, because you can sort of transit across into another world just for a second and then transit back again and then land back into the experience that you're having, but sort of refreshed by having like the micro vacation elsewhere. So it's sort of so if you have, you know, the ability to just look at, you know, something that gives you presence about, you know, whether other people are, you know, looking at something that you've built or, you know, that your store is out of pineapple or whatever it is that's in, you know, that's happening in a virtual world that you're participating in, you know, that gives you a kind of an uncanny pullback just for a second. And that's a little bit playful and kind of brings you, you know, into a different state.
So there was in the book, Got Game, there was an interesting thing, a discussion without an answer, which was whether multitasking actually works or not. And their conclusion was that it didn't work, but that it did was part of this kind of, and it was written by baby boomers, so the way they look at it is a little bit odd, but they basically said that kids have this multitasking thing where they do actually take a break from work by going to this little mini thing that for them would probably not be relaxing, but for us, having noise or having Twitter in the background is actually a way to sort of step back for a second and then come back into the. But do you think that multi, because you look at Justin and what he's doing, and I think to certain generations, it just looks like chaos. Right? But in fact, I think it ties in a little bit with this little mini vacation thing that you're talking about, which is to kind of reset and refresh your brain as you cycle through this thing. Because you can't really multitask, I don't think. I think you're actually switching.
Right.
But the switching actually is helpful for resetting.
Well, and that's right? What you have. I mean, you have that with your TeamSpeak coming over the speakers in your house, right? It's like the what? So I mean, just the idea that you can, the fact that you have the sort of slipstream to fall back into, you know, you provide yourself with this like stimuli that's going by from like an alternate place to be, you know, so you can just like, you know, you can refocus just for a second, you know, prairie dog up into this other, you know, this other space just for a moment and look around and then come back down to whatever it was you were doing before, you know, and it's like, it's very much, you know, like you're peeking over the edge of like into some other space entirely and then just kind of coming back down and working some more. So, and that's definitely, you know, it's that kind of, it's like, you know, whatever, respiration in between states to be in. So you sort of, you know, it becomes a pattern that I mean, I think that happens, you know, in, you know, a lot of times you see, like, I remember when I first started using, you know, computers back on the command line, there were the people that would every once in a while almost involuntarily type mail, which is the way you checked your mail under Unix. And it was like, it was not something that they actually thought they were going to have more mail, but it was just this kind of, it was a thing that allowed them to like take a step back into the possibility of something else just for a second and then go back to coding some more. But it was just a, you know, it's a context switching that's not actually all the way out into another task, but it's just a stepping back to see what the other possibilities might be and then coming back in again.
Hopefully they put 15 minutes in so they could get a bunching.
A bunching pin badge.
My name's Timothy. I'm from the Open Source Center. And one thing we do there is look at emerging media and new technologies and its effect abroad, specifically its effect on open and closed societies, the democratizing effect. And there's been a couple panels here at South by Southwest that have talked about mobile technology and mobile media and how, and it's democratizing effect, and social media and how it's its participatory nature is having an effect abroad. And I'm wondering, I know that, you know, maybe Joy, your sister maybe talks a little bit about this, I think, in her new book, but can you talk a little bit about how MMOs, or if you have any perspectives on how MMOs or gaming technology may also kind of contribute to that abroad?
And an opening and closing of society or participation levels going up?
Yeah, democratization, participative. And I don't mean specifically, you know, just like the protests against the National Front in Second Life, but along those sorts of lines. Or
I don't have a really good theoretical answer, but I can tell you a couple of specific things. So our guild is about 350 people. And and probably we're learning. I mean, we have town hall meetings, we have bylaws, we have a wiki. Probably the people who are in our guild have never thought to participate in a town hall meeting to argue about the governance of some kind of organization. And, you know, and we argue about whether we're a democracy or we're not, or whether we're a and we talk about all kinds of organizational things that. And to describe the diversity, I mean, we've got, you know, people who are deployed in Iraq. We've got former convicts. We've got policemen. We've got a priest. We've got, you know, country music singers. We've got a huge diversity. And there are two things that I think affected a little bit. That's kind of, and we've got all kinds of races. And so we actually have. I've had some young kids who've come in who are actually very racist, and I had to sit down and say, look, it's not cool. to say
you were probably sitting already.
I was already sitting, but it, by the way, I'm Japanese, and he goes, oh my God, I'm sorry, I said Japanese. I've never met a Japanese guy before. I'm sorry, and you know, and the guy that you just that just helped you, he's a truck driver, and what's so first of all, what's really interesting is some of these kids who have never participated in anything diverse suddenly realize how cool it is to be in a conversation between a Japanese kid and a priest and a guy in Iraq, and realize that that's one that's interesting. So in terms of political awareness, it's very interesting. And the second thing is this ability to organize, and then being empowering these people to participate. And one of the biggest problems in Japan that we find, it's only 6% of Japanese in a recent study said they felt they had any effect on the government. And I think what's interesting about participating in a guild with 350 people is a lot of the new guildies don't think that they can participate, but then they realize that they have a huge effect. And so that sort of thinking about activism is very important. Having said that, there are other surveys that say most people who play WoW aren't in guilds. The average guild is only one person. You know, so so I can't really generalize our guild out to the rest of the world, but the fact is that I think that there is a potential for that. I do know that the Chinese World of Warcraft forums are much more civilized than the American ones, and they have a larger population, so there might be stuff going on in Asia that I don't know. But I think, like with any tool, it's going to be those special cases that, when generalized, will change things, but if left to their own devices, might degenerate into something that's not very sophisticated. I don't know if you guys have any.
Well, I mean, it also goes back to a point you were making earlier about the type of leader that you find in a guild, you know, this idea that the person, you know, the person that's in charge is often the best listener rather than the best talker. So, and that has the fact that people have positive reinforcement about the way, you know, that it's something, you know, the successful organization is more like an open source project than a corporation, you know, inherently. Just the low level understanding of those organizational mechanics, you know, affect the way people relate to each other. So, you know, that you know, maybe opens things up, you know, because it presents a different way of talking about success. And so that's, you know, I don't know if that's...
So I'm taking a massively multiplayer online design class. I'm about to finish graduate school at the University of Southern California School of Cinematic Arts Interactive Media Division. And my teacher's name is Patricia Pizer, and she's a researcher in games. And she met this guy who made his own MMO. And it was called Blade Mistress Online. All the avatars were women because his wife said there weren't enough women in games. So he made this MMO populated entirely by women, and he let researchers come in and pull through the data and make experimental tweaks and stuff. So she got to go in, and there were only like 1,000, 1,500 players, but she was allowed to go in, and she did like conversational searches or like parsing when people use full sentences and they said please and thank you. And if someone said please or thank you and they used words of like kindness and consideration, then she like gave them sort of incidental rewards in the game. So she was trying to create that sense of an aura around them, and for the people who were partied with them or who were standing near them would have a better experience, so that you could sort of tweak the software to reward being social or doing, like if you gave a healing spell to someone who wasn't in your contact list, then you got a bonus from that, but it was hidden. So it was just sort of like trying to give this like underlying overall optimistic lift to the world, to give auras to nice people, which I think when I heard her talk about this in my class, I was like, wow, that sounds like the future of positive social engineering. I mean, I'm sure there's some terrible shadow side, of course, and yeah.
Hi, I'm Steve Grant. I'm a strategic planner. I guess I'm kind of reacting, or I got an idea off of the comment about Frederick Taylor earlier, and you know, hierarchical systems don't exist in corporations because people are assholes. They exist in corporations because it's a side effect of industrial processes of production. So, you know, at some point, somebody has to stand at a particular point in an assembly line and screw the lug nuts onto the hub of the car. And there's a tendency to rail against all this unnecessary hierarchy and we should be more playful in our lives. But, you know, seriousness has a role, too. And if I'm lying in the street bleeding, I don't want my EMT approaching me with a sense of play. Like, Hey, look, he's got a sucking chest wound. That's funny how that bubbles. You know, I'm wondering if the kind of organizing scheme or organizing metaphor for how we're relating to each other becomes sort of massively multiplayer gaming, which I think there's a good chance of that happening. What, I don't want to prematurely mourn the death of seriousness, but what happens to like mission critical things like cops? Like cops, I don't see them getting real playful.
I played in Joey's Guild for a little while. That's a great question. I played in Joey's Guild for a little while, and it was almost too serious for me.
Well,
so
I mean, it's 90% of what we do is not playful or fun at all. And I think that the key is that it has to have just the right balance. And so, for instance, a 40-man raid for the 8 hours that you're doing it usually is very serious. We have tremendous amounts of hierarchy. So our raid leader has the ability to kick anybody out just because they stepped in the wrong place or they didn't answer or they went AFK for 5 minutes. But the key is she also has to get everyone's attention focused for 8 hours, 40 people, right? And that's really hard without having some play, the right amount of balance of play. And just like you said, we don't want people to be goofing off when we have a really, really sophisticated, complicated action we're trying to do. So she has to figure out where she weaves the play into and how, and her voice has to be soothing and she can't bark orders, because the minute somebody says, oh, this sucks, and leaves, 5 other people leave, 10 other people leave. And this is actually what happens in startup companies a lot. Like I'm a venture capitalist, I invest, and there's some point when they stop staying up all night and they stop staying in the weekends and they start going home at 5 o'clock. And yeah, you can bark orders and be as serious as you want, but to motivate those people to listen to that hierarchy and to come in on the weekends, there has to be something there. And that's that ensemble thing. That ensemble is more than just play. It's something about achievement. It's something about reward. And there's a lot of sacrifice in World of Warcraft, but you get something back from it. And you do giggle. You get the giggles when you finish. And like you would get the giggles if you save somebody, but you don't get the giggles when you're doing the CPR. And so I think that we're not that different. It's just, and I think that, you know, it's really about a blend and the balance.
And one of the other things about play, I think, is that, I mean, there are multiple sort of definitions of play, and one of which, you know, we're talking about play as in games, but there's also play as in performance of instrumentation. And I think that's actually one of the things that's, you know, that we're sort of crossing over into is this idea that, I mean, one of the things about, you know, you used the example of a surgeon and a policeman, and one of the things that's interesting about both of those is that they're moving. I mean, when we sort of talk about this hypercritically analyzed possibility space that a game gives us, those people have been living in virtual reality of the law for a really long time. The moment of the surgeon and the moment of the policeman are the moments that the law is focused on as a complex system of rules. And the fact that we're gaining a critical understanding of the functioning of the model of complex systems like that mean that we can also begin to recognize our performance. You know, we can see, we're now, you know, one of Joey's plugins allows him to see his, you know, allows him to see all of these performance characteristics about how he's moving through. And so those serious tasks also, just in the literacy of those tools for analyzing, you know, performance within systems of constraint, are, you know, giving better knowledge. I mean, there are things that have already existed. Simulation design exists in surgery and in police, you know, in policing. It has existed a long time occupationally before it arrived in gaming. You know, it's almost trickled down into gaming from those professions. And so, you know, the fact that that is becoming popular literacy, that idea of simulation and the consequences that can be, you know, experimented with in that space but not in reality, you know, is not necessarily playful in the game sense, but playful in kind of this instrumental sense of becoming, having virtuosity inside of a system.
Right. So you could get, if you're really curious and you haven't heard enough, you could get Trauma Center for the Wii or the DS, which is a game where you have to surgerate on
surgerate.
People. Yeah.
Hey, guys. Jerry Papendorf, Lecture Sheep Company. Joey started the panel here talking about the differences between Second Life and World of Warcraft, where World of Warcraft has all these stats and leveling and achievements. And I've been working on some frameworks for life logging and almost passively multiplayer gaming applied to open virtual worlds like Second Life that don't have any gaming or leveling, but I feel like there's that World of Warcraft element that's missing. So there's so much data in that world about who you talk to and where you go and the kinds of activities that you have, that's the great kind of stuff to collect and track to put up to kind of like create the leaderboards and achievements. I was wondering, Justin, if you had thought about applying PMogging to anything like open or social virtual worlds, where I think there's a lot richer data about what's going on than just like web trafficking. I mean, you have like everything from like gestures to being in environments with other people where you're just doing things in differently than being on web pages. So there's a richer level of things that you can track. And then for Joey, I had a question.
Okay, let me answer that quick. Because I think basically I decided I tried to put the time. I tried to find those Friday night 8-hour blocks to join the 40-person serious party on the dragon killing thing, and I couldn't work it out. And I said, but I'm already spending this time on my computer. I want to get levels for that. But so I'm mapping a world that I know about, which is web surfing and some lightweight social apps. If I spent a lot of time in Second Life, it would become clear to me how to slice it up. The challenge of how to slice and describe web life sort of keeps me awake and makes me feel inadequate. So I don't spend a lot of time thinking outside of that right now because I'm just trying to make the level map and the sort of parsing of web activity. Right. But I think there's a tremendous amount of opportunity to bring these dynamics. And SL Stats, Mark Barrett, who already tried to do some monitoring of people in Second Life and.
That's the, I mean I'm kind of the futurist guy, so I tend to kind of like think about things that head into in motion. The difference being, like, I know you want to track the web because that's what it is that you do. That's where you spend your time. I think about life logging and passive multiplayer gaming and Second Life as a better metaphor for how I want to track my entire life.
Oh, yeah. So I thought about the mobile space. And I guess, yeah, in terms of relationships, it's like who you were with and then were you with a lot of people or a constrained number of people? And did you go to a lot of locations or stay in one location? Did you talk a lot or message a lot? And you could – but, you know, all of this gets back to – imperialist decisions, right? What do we want to reward? And how can you reward as many sets of behaviors as possible to allow people to feel that they're creative and achieving in lots of areas? And I think leaderboards is an easy way to get a sense of multiplayer going, but that's woefully inadequate. And you might need fiction. I tried to do it without fiction. You are a web surfer. You are collecting HTML. It is a brave adventure. It's bullshit. I couldn't make it work. So I had to add fiction. So I think Second Life, you know, or mobile phone will probably need the same thing. So, Robin, were you waving your hand?
Yeah, I was just going to say maybe you want the actual participants to be doing that rewarding for you as opposed to trying to...
Deciding their own rewards.
Yeah, I mean, I think that one of the things is that you're trying to supplement some sort of reward structure that's supposed to reward connection or behavior in a world space. Why not let the other players, in this case people in your life, reward you? The question would be, are you really open to that feedback? Feedback is a gift, but it might not be.
Right, that's true. So one of the things on the profiles, we had traits where you could describe yourself as someone whose posture has been adversely affected through computer use. We were going to allow other people to put traits on you. So what if somebody said your posture has been adversely affected by computer use, as an example? That's a very different experience. I think you're right. And what I look forward to is to playing with all that and letting that happen and doing it gently with other people. And you had another question. That woman's waving her hand around. That probably means one more question from the guy who's already at the mic. Okay.
Okay. Do you have time for one quick one on that? Or was that a no? Or a... Okay, so real fast then. So probably, like, I think the coolest thing that you're getting at here is that the tracking that's going on...
Wait, you were going to have a question for Joey.
Yeah. It's going to go right. It's going to slide right into this for him. Is that you don't have to go to any kind of site to manually update this information. So it's you, by behaving, this is tracking you. And so, Joey, recently you invested in a site called Rupture, which is a social network site for World of Warcraft that's doing something similar right now, where it's taking your behavior and your play and your achievements in World of Warcraft, and it's using that your behavior directly in the world to drive information about you on a social networking site. So I was just interested to hear a little bit about that and where you thought that Rupture might go and what that might be prototyping.
Well, Rupture is directly competitive with Justin because it takes what I do in World of Warcraft, my serious life of World of Warcraft, and actually tries to make a game out of it. But seriously, it's actually very similar because it tracks all your data and it tries to pull it out. So here's like our guild. You can see like best clear times, which is the statistics of how long it took to down each of our bosses, and you can go into particular fights and you can see who was there, and eventually we have all kinds of stuff like, you know, how many, who took the most potions, who was the most summoned, and it builds, it takes all the data that you're doing when you're actually in the game, and then allows you to do it much more passively outside of the game, and you know, it's already kind of what we do. I mean, we sit around on the forums and in chat on the phone talking about the game, and the game is, I mean, the Molten Core is kind of like the Christmas ball where everybody shows up and it's a big event. And then playing the game is kind of like the real-life face-to-face interactions you have. But just like in real life, you have email interactions and IM interactions. So this is just kind of amplifying the fact that you can organize the stuff that's not actually happening in the game.
I was just going to bring up an anecdote, which is that, you know, people that have this meta-knowledge of what's going on in a game are often... the designers actually are really interested in hearing feedback from them, actually. And in our experience on Game Never Ending, there was a user who was doing a lot of tracking of all this metadata in the game, and it turned out that he was so good at doing that that Ludicorp hired him. Cal was the person that actually made all of these visualizations about what was going on in our world that we'd built, and he actually knew more about what was going on in our world that we built than we did. So we figured we should probably bring him inside. It was sort of the last Starfighter moment where the van pulled up, you know, and like took Cal away and brought him into the game world. You know, sent him into the game grid, I guess, as we were talking about earlier. But it's definitely you know, that type of meta knowledge about how the mechanics of the game are working gives you insight into the pattern. There are, you know, sort of these patterns of, you know, gameplay that are consciously or unconsciously encoded by the designers in the thing that they're making, and you can start to reveal those if you have tools to visualize the statistical reality of the game. If you look at a site, there's a site out there right now that's called Swivel, which is a web application for doing data visualization that allows you to just import random data set. You know, you can take your own data set and import it into the web tool. There's also a project at IBM Research called Many Eyes, which is sort of the same thing. And one of the main things that people are using this tool for is importing data from a data feed online about World of Warcraft and where the big drops, you know, like who are the bosses that drop the most valuable stuff. So you can make all these graphs and charts about like which lands have the best return on investment, you know. So you should look into those.
And one last thing I'll mention here is this is kind of exactly where the collision between the web world and the gaming world is happening. I mean, World of Warcraft could have an API for each of the monsters so that we know when they died or when they did that. But no, we have to go through and parse what each monster says to figure out whether he's alive or he's dead. And every time the script changes, we have to rewrite everything. And so right now, the games aren't very friendly to this kind of crawling. And the good thing about why Justin has a lead on us is that a lot of the web apps that we have are really easy to build on and make these kinds of games from. And in fact, I think the gaming industry in general is negative about people sort of drafting off of them for value. Whereas I think, you know, the whole notion of the web is that small pieces loosely joined and everybody working together. And I think that collaborative environment really isn't part of the big studio thing. And so it'll be interesting to see what happens, whether the web guys will figure out gaming or whether the gaming guys will figure out the web.
Thank you guys so much for staying. And yeah.